From the Gettysburgian at 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Ben Ponce, and this is On Target.
I'm Gari Mangala, and today on Target, we will be discussing Sigma Nu and SAI's philanthropic event, CanJam, and the first-year read.
Then I'll sit down with Bob Callen, the Vice President for Development, Alumni, and Parent Relations. Stay with us. All right, let's get into the news. So, Gari, you recently, we're recording this on Saturday for reference, and you recently came from an event that involved singing and can jam, perhaps not in that order.
It was essentially in that order. I went to Sigma Nu's philanthropic event that they were hosting with SAI, the music fraternity, the all-female music fraternity on campus, where they were donating.
What does SAI stand for?
Sigma Alpha Iota.
Okay. We were tripping over some Greek letters earlier, so I just thought that would do a pop quiz.
So everyone who came either donated a canned good or $3, and that will all go to our local soup kitchen. There was Can Jam, Spark Notes, Drop the Octave, and a band called Opposite Horizons or something like that also performed.
Yeah, that's John Glennon's operation. I don't know what they're called. I call it John Glennon's operation.
Yeah, but it was really fun. It was pretty low-key. They had, like, burgers and soda and can jam, obviously, and Frisbee. And we were all just kind of sitting around in the sun. It's a nice day today, so it was fun to be outside.
Yeah, well, I mean, we are having some not horrific weather this weekend at Gettysburg College after the deluges of the past month have resulted in, for example, the Bullets marching band having, by my count, two practices that have been uninterrupted by miscellaneous forms of precipitation and or swamps on practice fields in the last month. But I digress.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was definitely still muddy on the grass, but it was sunny outside and it was fun. I enjoyed the stylings of the a cappella groups, and I think
The stylings.
And I think it's always great when we have events like this that are just, you know, good, clean, fun, but also for a good cause.
Yeah. And so also this week, there was some student and I guess you could also say faculty and administrator activism on the Gettysburg College campus.
Yeah. Last Monday, we saw at 1 p.m. in Penn Hall, the Gettysburg campus took part in the national walkout in support of Dr. Ford and Deborah Ramirez. They both accused the Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. We have seen that news kind of change within the recent days. Ben, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, so yesterday on Thursday, I think TVs across campus and frankly across the country, I read a figure that some 20 million people watched the Senate Judiciary Committee's hearing. But Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who interestingly, and I think this was something that was interesting during her hearing, she's a psychologist, a clinical psychologist, and was essentially testifying both as about what she experienced in 1982 and about the psychological effects thereof, which was kind of an interesting dichotomy there. And then subsequently, Kavanaugh gave some fairly fiery testimony in which he denounced both the accusation and the Senate Judiciary Committee, which he said has turned advise and consent into search and destroy. And so I think it was a fairly, I don't imagine that many people change their minds in either direction after watching those hearings. And so coming into that hearing was on Thursday. On Friday, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved 11-10 on a party line vote Kavanaugh's confirmation. However, in the immediate aftermath, Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, a retiring Republican, said that he would not vote for Kavanaugh on final confirmation in the full Senate until the FBI completed a follow-up investigation, which the Republican leadership has grudgingly acquiesced to, and the president has authorized. So that will take another week, and I imagine in another week we'll be in a fairly similar place to where we are now. It's worth noting that the Gettysburg opinion pages have seen a couple of arguments on this particular issue. Chris Condon opened the conversation by urging folks to reserve judgment until after the hearings, talking about the importance of due process. I think he would argue both in the legal sense and in the broader public opinion sense. Subsequently, Lauren Cole weighed in that the most important reaction, the most important thing folks can do is to believe the accusations and the stories that have been told by survivors of sexual assault, including Dr. Ford and Deborah Ramirez, from whom we have not heard since a piece in The New Yorker. And so, you know, I think there's a range of opinions across the country and across the Gettysburg College community, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes from here. It's worth noting that on Monday there were approximately somewhere between 80 and 100 people who turned out for this rally in some slightly less than pleasant weather. I mean, it was part of the ongoing deluge, I suppose you could say. And, you know, it was the third or fourth time since I've been a Gettysburg College student at which there was a rally of some sort on the Penn Hall steps. It seems to have kind of become a venue at which people protest. And so I think that it's not surprising that that's the venue was chosen for this particular event.
Definitely. And I think since then, a lot of conversations, especially within groups that are supporting Ford and Ramirez, have change from ones of let's talk about this and let's watch everything to let's make sure that we're respecting people that maybe want to stay out of this conversation for a little bit for their own mental health. And we're seeing that discourse taking flight a lot around campus. A lot of people, when we were talking about, you know, TVs all across campus were playing this, but also making sure you're understanding why certain people do not want to take part in this as much.
Yeah, interestingly enough, the Women's Center and tweeted probably the most closest thing to an official stance of the college that anyone has seen. The Women's Center tweeted, "We support Christine Blasey Ford and all victims of sexual assault. This is not a partisan issue. It's assault. Let her bravery to speak out inspire us all." I think that there's been some chatter that I've heard among some students who questioned why an office on campus is taking a position on this issue, although I think there are many who would argue that, you know, believing the stories that people share is not really taking a side on an issue. It's just something that one should do. And I think there are others who would disagree with that, and that's probably about as intractable a situation as we have culturally and across campus today.
Yeah, and on Tuesday, was it? We saw the first year class of 2022, got to have their first year read, discussion, talk, what have you. Ben, if I remember correctly, the book that was chosen was one that you had suggested.
Well, I'm not going to take credit for having chosen the first year read.
But are you going to deny credit?
I'm also not going to deny it.
That's what I thought.
The book this year was Just Mercy, written by Brian Stevenson, who his own story is fascinating. He was a law student, got assigned to do some legal clinic work, helping death row inmates file appeals in the South, went into it thinking it was going to be drudgerous and terrible and ended up making a career out of it. One of the folks that he assisted over the years was a gentleman named Anthony Ray Hinton, who came to campus this week to speak about Stevenson's book. Stevenson was not available to talk about the book Just Mercy, which is what they read. Anthony Ray Hinton was featured in that book and has written a book of his own. And so he told his story, which was also I'm not going to say fairly compelling. I think it's fair to say it was very compelling, of how he was on death row for 30 years for a murder that it turned out he did not, in fact, commit. And so, you know, I think that issues of how the criminal justice system treats people, and particularly people of color, was on the minds of the committee when they chose that particular book, and I imagine was on the minds of the first-year class as they heard from Mr. Hinton. One of our Gettysburgian reporters had an interview with Anthony Ray Hinton, although I'm told that although she went into the interview prepared with many questions, she asked one question and he talked for the full length of the interview on that one question. I imagine that he has quite a lot to say, and clearly that was the case in that interview and during the event. In talking to many first years who read the book, they enjoyed the read, found it, Just Mercy is not a dense book. You know, it's a page turner, but one that I think is a page turner not because it's shallow or flighty, but that it's a compelling narrative that is rooted in a lot of stories that resonate with folks.
Definitely, I right after that, one first year had come to a rehearsal for a show, and she was just a little bit out of it, and I didn't know why at first, because I guess I'd forgotten that the first year read discussion was that night, and she told me that she was really shaken up by just how serious the conversation got, but she said that it was an important conversation to have, and she was glad that she got that opportunity, and I think that's how a lot of the class of 2022 feels about discussing these things so early on, you know, in their college careers.
Well, the goal of the first year read program is to kind of provide a common intellectual experience right out of the gate. And I guess it's fair to say that the book that may or may not have been suggested by someone on this podcast succeeded in that regard.
And it wasn't me, for context.
Okay. Well, other than that, on Monday, the Student Senate finally, I feel like we've talked about this 74 times on this podcast, so here comes 75, has approved its changes to the Constitution that officially establish the consolidation of committees and appoint the affinity group leaders. So I'll just read quickly. The affinity group leaders representing the academic affinity group, Ryan Schimmel, Arts and Music, Jenna Pavis, the Cultural, Mark Manu, the Political Group, Josh Gonzalez, the Religious Group, Laura Fodale, Service, Sydney Kaplan, and Social, Rhiannon Winner. So there were seven affinity groups were formed. Each club that is recognized by Student Senate is represented by one of these affinity groups, and those club representatives elected a voting member as their affinity group leader. And so those folks will now join the four senators representing each class, the seven at-large senators, and the members of the executive board that are not the president and the vice president in having full voting authority, privileges. I don't know what the word is there. No. Power.
Yeah, not only that, but they also have to all serve on a committee just like every other senator. Which is one of the other discussions that was had. They kind of combined some committee groups, and I know there's been certain issues that we had last year, and I think based on some of the emails that I've seen Marissa Belanda start sending out, we may be having issues again with attendance in committees.
I chatted with my good friend Nick Arbaugh, the president of Student Senate, a couple days ago, and he said that there were several people that have not attended a committee meeting, and he intends to publicly name and shame at the next Senate meeting folks who have been lax slash absent in their committee attendance. And I think that, you know, it's going to be, it is definitely a point of emphasis for this Student Senate Executive Board that attendance procedures are going to be followed. And frankly, if the Senate is going to be the, you know, activist body, it needs to have full participation.
Definitely. So if you're looking to watch those call-outs happen, the Gettysburgian does live stream every Student Senate meeting, and sometimes it's better than cable TV, I would say.
Well, arguably, considering we don't have cable TV at Gettysburg College, it's your only choice.
Yeah.
So you might as well tune in.
Definitely.
One other note, a side note from this Senate meeting. Some people have been confused about the new one of the four new clubs that was recognized, the Austrian Economics Club.
Yes.
I would just like to make a general public service announcement that Austrian economics refers not to the economics of the country of Austria, but of the school of thought of economics contrasted with Keynesian economics, known as Austrian economics, espoused by such economists as Friedrich Hayek, and that was the ruling economic school of thought perhaps during the Reagan administration.
Yep. And the other three clubs that were recognized were Historical Society, Interfaith Council, and Shots in the Dark Improv Comedy, which is not about guns, which some senators thought it was about.
Okay, well, maybe these eponymous clubs could do a better job clarifying their missions, but the Austrian Economics Club in particular seems to be confusing many people who, I guess, don't study economics, which everyone should. Not an econ major, just a general observation that people should. All right, what other news and notes do we have on the docket?
Well, I think, Ben, you're going to Allentown tomorrow. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
No. But I guess I could anyway. The Bullets Marching Band is attending the Allentown Collegiate Marching Band Festival. That's tomorrow, which by the time this podcast airs will have been either yesterday or several days ago. It's on Sunday, September the 30th. There are maybe 20 bands from various colleges, ranging in size from Pennsylvania State schools up to other Pennsylvania State schools that are larger, you know, Clarion to Westchester. There's a bit of a dichotomy there. And right in the middle at 2:30 in the afternoon, the Bullets Marching Band will set fire to the place. You're looking at me like I need to explain what I mean. No, not committing arson. The show is entitled Fire and includes music such as Great Balls of Fire, Burn, Firework, Chariots of Fire, and the Phoenix, which really doesn't have anything to do with fire, although I guess, you know, theoretically, mythology. I don't understand the mythology of the Phoenix. Someone else suggested that song.
Phoenix is when they die, they ignite, and then they are reborn from the ashes.
Okay, well, thanks for that lesson.
You're welcome.
Anyway, so the Bullets Marching Band, Allentown. All right, I think that's going to put an end, mercifully, to this news segment. We'll be back with the Bullet Report and then my chat with Bob Callen. And now it's time for the Bullet Report. It's been a fairly dull week in Gettysburg College sports action. On September the 24th, the men's golf team finished 3rd of 8 at the Moravian Wayhill Classic. The women's soccer team lost 1-0 to Frostburg State. The field hockey team lost 3-0 to Stevenson. The men's soccer team defeated McDaniel 3-1. The volleyball team lost to Susquehanna 3-1. The women's tennis team defeated Catholic 6-3. And that's all that's happened since we last did the Bullet Report. And we're thrilled to be joined today by the Vice President for Development, Alumni, and Parent Relations, Bob Callen. Mr. Callen, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Ben. Thanks for asking me.
So I thought we could start with sort of how you got into college fundraising and maybe even into fundraising in particular, which, you know, is not something that most people get an undergraduate degree in. So how did you get into fundraising?
Great question. I actually got my undergraduate degree in biology from Bucknell.
And a natural path.
Totally natural path. And then I was, after I graduated, I was out in the work world for about a year and decided I wanted to go back to get a master's degree. And I went back to Bucknell. And as part of my graduate school income, I did an internship in the development office. Uh-huh. And I never looked back.
Yeah.
So I've been in it since 1979.
And so you came to Gettysburg in 2009 after you had been in fundraising and at both colleges and in the private sector.
I was the bulk of my career has been higher education, Bucknell for 18 years, Bowdoin College for almost 10 years, 3 years in healthcare fundraising with Geisinger Health System. And then, I actually started here in January of 2010.
Uh-huh. So. And what made you decide to come to Gettysburg, apply for that job?
I blame it on our daughter. So our daughter, Abby, fell in love with this place and applied early decision. Came in with the class of 2012. Given my profession, the folks in my own division spotted the fact that I was a fundraiser and asked my wife and me to serve on the parents' board. So I came to one meeting in the spring of 2010, excuse me, and then this job opened up in June of 2010, and so I was working in healthcare at the time, missing higher education, and I decided to apply for it, and it all worked out. So
right, and then so shortly after you arrived, then I imagine the planning began for the Gettysburg Great Campaign that has, I imagine, consumed most of your tenure here over the last, I guess, 8 years. Right. Can you talk a little bit about how the planning for that campaign got started and just sort of how it developed it began in a sort of a private phase, mm-hmm. and then the public phase launched, I guess, 4 years ago.
Right. Actually, I started, my first day on the job was January 18th, and our first campaign planning committee meeting was something like February 1st. So, my colleagues in the office had already recruited a campaign planning committee, which was exclusively trustee members, with the help of outside counsel, Washburn and McGoldrick, Sue Washburn, who'd been affiliated with the college since the mid-90s. And we put together a multi-year plan to try to tackle what was initially a working goal of $125 million over 6 years. Mm-hmm. So we launched the what we called the leadership phase. Some colleges call it the quiet phase or the silent phase, but we called it the leadership phase in June of 2011. And by May of 2014, we had raised about $75 million, which we felt pretty confident that we were on a good path, a good track, and the board approved a final goal of $150 million over 7 years. So that was at first a bit daunting to think about that given the history of the fundraising here, but we tackled it head on.
So. Yeah. And so how did the first number of $125 million come to be, and how did the, you know, $150 million goal was, you know, is there a benchmark that you can raise twice, you know, what you raise in the initial mm-hmm. phase and the public phase? Is that kind of where that came from? Or
there are some axioms in fundraising. One of those is that you like it, especially for modern day campaigns now, and some schools are running multi-billion dollar campaigns.
I was reading about Harvard recently.
Oh,
$9 billion.
Yeah,
or something.
Stanford, Harvard, most of the Ivies. We knew we wanted to get, by the time we were ready to launch the public phase, we wanted to get to at least 50% of whatever our ultimate goal was going to be. So again, we tested 125. We got to May of 2014, saw we were at 75, thought, you know what, given our bandwidth and the work that we've done, we feel if you know you've got the goal in the bag, it's not a stretch goal. And right. So we figured we saw about $120 million, but we didn't see $150. I will say that after an extensive meeting in Philadelphia with our board chair, Jim Schemmel, and our campaign co-chairs, Bob Joseph and Steve Cloding, we walked away from that with 150 over seven, and it was a long train ride home trying to figure out, okay, I'm not sure where the rest of this is coming from, but we've got another 4 years to figure it out.
So. Right. How do you, you know, you kind of alluded to this, but how did you go about, you start with $0 in the bank and
right.
you end up with $150 million in the bank, and how right. does that, you know, transpire? What do you think about? How do you approach starting something like that?
Well, you have to look at your pool of prospective donors. Mm-hmm. And so we took a really long, hard look at that, did all kinds of analytics. And at the end of the day, as I told the staff, philanthropy is a voluntary act. We can't make anybody donate. So you try to align the donor's values and what's important to them and the impact that they want to have with the college's priorities. And you ask people to join you in this enterprise. And so we had what we called the nucleus group pretty well figured out, and we'd had some preliminary conversations. And then we really got out of the chute pretty quickly with some lead gifts. John Jakers, $5 million for the endowment. There were some other significant lead gifts, mostly from trustees, in the mix. And then after that, it's just blocking and tackling all the way to the goal line. So.
Right. And so ultimately, you know, the campaign exceeded the $150 million goal. I believe the final number was just a little over $160 million.
Correct.
And so what would you say were some of the keys to success in, you know, meeting and exceeding the goal that exceeded the initial goal?
No question. You know, I'll start with our staff, the core development alumni and parent relations staff. It's an incredibly talented crew. We stayed very focused on the key priorities of the campaign. The last campaign, the Unfinished Work campaign, which ran from 1999 to 2004, had so many goals that nobody could keep it straight. I mean, it was a very complex campaign. We decided to keep this very simple. There were five primary objectives, and we did not stray from those. And I think that focus really helped us. The board was incredibly generous. The board gave almost 28% of the $160 million. So kudos to the board. But the other person who deserves tremendous credit for the success of this, of course, is President Riggs. Mm-hmm. She was tireless. We dragged her all over not only the continental United States, but foreign countries as well. And she was just so dedicated to the cause, as we all know she is. She loves this place and wants to see it succeed. So
the five goals of the campaign, I know one was student scholarship support, and another was about supporting faculty. Can you talk about what the other goals were and which of those were all of the goals met?
So, good question. We had five, what we called the five big buckets. The first was student scholarship support. Our goal was, I think, $53 million, and we raised about $48 million towards that. That was a big, big stretch for us, but I'm very pleased with the outcome. Even though we fell short of the designated goal, we still made tremendous progress. The second, as you mentioned, was faculty support, and we ended up endowing seven faculty positions and then one of the Eisenhower Institute expert in residence positions. The other three big buckets were engaged learning, and that goal was about $20 million, and we snuck over that goal. That's internships, externships, immersion experiences, student faculty research. We raised a tremendous amount of money for student faculty research and have greatly expanded that. Mm-hmm. Especially the summer program. So that was the third bucket. The fourth bucket was plank, the renovation of the building we're sitting in. And we struggled, candidly, with that. Gettysburg has had a history of falling short in facilities fundraising. I think there were a couple of reasons that we fell short. I'm not sure there was the same sense of urgency for renovating this facility, renovating plank, as there was for perhaps some of the other things on the list. And then the fifth and final bucket, of course, was our current operations fundraising, annual giving, the Gettysburg Fund, which is unrestricted current operations support, Orange and Blue, which is our athletic fundraising. And that far exceeded its goal. So the number one, in terms of those five buckets, the we raise the most for annual giving, the second most for student scholarships.
Right. And with respect to Planck specifically, I know that that was going to be focused on sort of a global, creating a global center to bring many of the offices on campus under one roof that focus in that area. Why is it that you think that that was maybe not as compelling to prospective donors as some of the other priorities? And where does that project go from here, if anywhere?
Good question. I think that I think because a lot of the people and programs that would benefit from a renovated Planck were still programs that we raised money for, even if they lived in Glatfelter or Carlisle Street. So I think the venue itself was not as compelling as some of the programmatic support that we actually did raise for the Center for Global Education and some other other programs and departments. We are dedicated to continuing to fundraise for the building. We had a target of about $18 million for the campaign. We raised a third of that, so we're not stopping. So somebody else will have to carry the torch.
So I was going to say that'll be your successor's, one of your successor's objectives. Right. So that project is still something that the college sees value in and would like to see happen.
Right. Right.
And I know another goal of the campaign was to step up our endowment, where I know that historically the college has lagged behind some of its peer institutions, places like F&M and Dickinson and Bucknell to a larger extent. To what extent did the campaign help Gettysburg catch up, and where is there work, I imagine, still needing to be done on that front?
Great question, Ben. The endowment component of the $150 million goal was $90 million, and that endowment came in different flavors, the scholarship support, the engaged learning, et cetera. We actually secured $93 million in commitments for the endowment. So we exceeded the endowment goal, the overall endowment goal for the campaign. But our endowment fundraising needs to continue to be robust. Everybody else is in a campaign. Everybody else has got endowment in their campaign. So it's a never-ending catch up for us. As an institution, we got a late start on endowment fundraising. And so we're at a competitive disadvantage there. But we did, at least relative to ourselves, we made great strides in this campaign for the endowment.
Right. And sort of more broadly, and you touched on this a second ago, why is it that, you know, Gettysburg did get a late start on that? You know, there's kind of a comment that people have made on campus that while other schools were graduating doctors and lawyers, Gettysburg was a Lutheran school that was graduating preachers and teachers, and, you know, their earning potential is not what some of other schools were. Is that, you know, is there truth in that? Or, you know, where is it that Gettysburg kind of fell behind in that? And you know, how does that help or hurt the ability to get back on track with respect to endowment fundraising?
I think that, you know, I can't authoritatively speak to the preachers and teachers. I've heard the same, you know, same comment. I think it just needs to be a fundraising focus. For example, the Unfinished Work campaign raised a very modest amount for endowment, because there were other institutional priorities that were placed higher than that. This just happened to be a campaign that was there was a very strong endowment component to it, and I can't imagine that future campaigns, and even when we're not in a campaign, we're aggressively raising money for the endowment. Time is critical in any kind of endowment conversation. Once you, assuming that most schools get relatively the same return on their endowment within a few percentage points, you know, when you start with a lower base and you have a 5% growth, the gap gets wider and wider the further out you go. So trying to play catch up is a tough game. It really is.
And, you know, one thing with the endowment that, you know, you were talking earlier about, you know, relating to donors on a compelling narrative level, do you find that the endowment is an easier sell that, you know, their gift grows over time, or a more tricky sell insofar as you don't necessarily see the impact of your gift right away?
That's a great question. And we actually try to talk to donors about both. So, for example, if someone wants to endow a scholarship, it requires a minimum of $50,000. However, if they don't want to wait till they get to the $50,000, which some people have to do over time, they can also give current spendable dollars restricted for scholarships. So we often work with donors to realize their endowment impact sooner rather than later. And in many cases, when someone has us in their estate plans, we thank them, but we also begin the conversation about whether they'd like to see some of the impact while they're still alive. And and those are sensitive conversations, but many of our donors have started that way, and they get excited about the outcome and the impact that they're having.
Right. So. Is that, you know, I guess more broadly, how has college fundraising sort of changed over the years that you've been at Gettysburg, and I know that you've been at other institutions before? Is the endowment piece something that is more urgent now than it was before, or?
I think it just depends on the institution and where you are in your in kind of the spectrum of what's important at the moment. I can't imagine that there will ever be a campaign in Gettysburg's future that doesn't include endowment of some kind. Mm-hmm. Really, the three big buckets are current operations, support, endowment, and facilities. And I cannot imagine a future campaign without some fairly significant endowment component in it. And the endowment does resonate with donors.
Right. And so you kind of have alluded to this maybe a few times, but how long is it that you imagine before Gettysburg will launch the Gettysburg Greater campaign?
I love the way you put that, Ben, because goals don't go down, do they? Well, we've got, obviously, with President Riggs, her last year, and a new president coming in next year, there's going to be a transition period. We also have donors who have multi-year pledges that they're paying out for the next 2 to 3, 4 years. So I personally, I can't see another campaign launching, even the leadership phase, the quiet phase of another campaign launching for at least another 3 years. Mm-hmm.
And do donors have a sense of, you know, fatigue after one campaign that, you know, there's, if you start another one too early, it'll be less likely to be as successful? Is that a...
That's certainly something you have to be sensitive to. Because this was a 7-year campaign, we actually went back to people who gave early and made a 5-year pledge. We went back to them in year 6 and said, would you like to continue? And in some cases, they said yes, and they continued to the end of the campaign. In some cases, they said yes and signed on for another 5 years. Mm-hmm. So we do have a tail on this campaign in terms of some activity beyond that right. finish line.
And so speaking of the finish line, I know that your finish line at Gettysburg College is coming up soon. You're retiring in, I guess, almost less than 2 weeks now.
Next Friday,
October the 5th. So as you kind of look back on your time at Gettysburg College, I assume this campaign would be the answer to the question, but what are some of your, you know, proudest moments as leading the development office at Gettysburg?
Yeah, definitely the campaign was all-consuming, and that was our big focus, my big focus for most of my tenure here. The thing I'm most proudest of is our daughter's graduation from here. But in terms of the work that we've done, we had more than 25,000 donors to this campaign. Whether you believe in rankings or not, we've landed on the Princeton Review Best Alumni Network list. That didn't exist before the campaign. I think the campaign has served as a rallying cry for a lot of our alumni and parents to get more involved with the college. So I'm very proud of what we achieved as a goal, but I'm very proud of what we've set up in terms of kind of the structure and the ethos of how we do and what we do going forward.
Yeah. So. And last Saturday, there was a large-scale celebration of the campaign that occurred out on Memorial Field in a what was called a tent, although, right. honestly, I think that that structure could be better described as a temporary building, complete with doors and air conditioning and everything else. You know, talk a little bit about how the celebration was, you know, a good a cap to the campaign, and then also, you know, one kind of snickering comment that some people have made on campus is, you know, all the money that they spent on that, could that have gone elsewhere? What was the approximate price tag of that event? And was that something that, you know, an alum or a donor supported so that there wasn't overhead cutting into the other results of the campaign?
First of all, the event itself was designed to be kind of the capstone of the campaign, the 7 years of the campaign. We had a launch of the campaign back in 2014 in where we converted the gymnasium to the venue where we celebrated the launch of the campaign. This time, we actually had too many people and couldn't fit them in the gym, so the tent structure was really the only venue that would accommodate. And then, of course, Monday night, we had our thank you for our employee donors under that same tent. There's no question there was a cost. There's a cost to raising money. I think the best way I can frame this, Ben, is when you look at the 7 years of the campaign all in, for every dollar that we spent for staff, operating costs, one-time campaign expenses, we brought in almost $3 in gift revenue. Saturday evening's event and Monday, to a lesser extent, the funding for those events, that's not in my operating budget. We actually have some unrestricted bequests that helped support special one-time expenses related to the campaign. It's something we set up actually before I got here. So
the fundraising, you know, you mentioned just a second ago, what was the, as a percentage then, for every dollar that you put in, you said $3?
Almost $3
were coming out. And is that a benchmark that, you know, in terms of context, is that considered a good rate of return for a campaign like this?
That's a good question. You know, it's certainly a decent rate of return. A lot of it depends on the institution, the magnitude of the campaign. You know, I happen to know a little bit about Cornell's program, and you know, they'll probably have a multi-billion-dollar campaign. They also have 400 development people. We have 54 in our division, all in. So I think that's certainly a respectable ratio. You know, spending about 35 cents on the dollar.
Right. So. And so, you know, looking more broadly as for any students or folks who may be listening that will find themselves in a position at some point in their careers where they have to make an ask.
Right.
You know, that's what you've been doing your entire career.
Right.
What would you say is the key to making an ask ultimately for money from people?
I think that the first thing you have to get used to is rejection. So you can't take no personally. I have always believed that giving is an extremely personal thing. And that our job, yes, at some point you need to put a number on the table with someone, but if you're doing it the right way, you're actually framing it as an investment, and you've spent enough time with that individual to understand what they want to accomplish. My favorite question to ask someone I'm in conversation with is, what impact do you want to have at your alma mater? And dream with me on that. And then let's talk about whether we can make some or all of that come true. So it's really, I go back to what I said earlier, it's really about connecting the donor's values with the institutional priorities. People give because of the mission of the institution. They believe in the mission. They believe in the leadership of the institution, and ultimately they want to have some kind of impact that they can see.
So. And with 25,000 donors to the most recent campaign, you know, what buckets were those donors in? I mean, obviously, I'm assuming many, if not most, were alumni.
Correct.
But what other types of people supported the campaign, and you know, are those areas into which future fundraising may expand at the mm-hmm. college?
So the bulk, as you said, the bulk of our support came from alumni. 65% of the campaign total came from alums. And then after that, the next largest constituency was actually foundations. Private mm-hmm. foundations gave about 20% of the campaign, foundations and corporations, and parents and friends. So that those were the main categories of sources of support, but the alumni by far were the majority.
And you mentioned on Monday there was an employee mm-hmm. gathering, and so employees gave a significant amount to the campaign?
This is something that we need to actually crow more about. We had 700 employees and retirees give $4.4 million to this campaign. And when you get that kind of internal endorsement, when we were talking with alumni and parents on the road and they heard that, they were like, okay, if the home crowd's investing, we should take a serious look at this. So that was a very compelling fact to build into our conversations with our alums and parents and friends. When the internal group is making that kind of investment.
Right. And so then finally, two questions. One is, you have a bit of a reputation as sort of an early riser and a hard charger and then a, you know, someone who doesn't stay up all night going to late night events like the campaign celebration.
Right.
Would you say that was a key to your professional success over the years?
I was never an early morning person until our first child was born in 1987. And we also lived in Maine where the sun comes up a little earlier. So I just found the morning was my best energy. So I would always joke with President Riggs about, I'm happy to have three breakfasts starting at 5 a.m., but one dinner that starts at 7:30 just kills me. So
right.
So the thing I'm looking forward to most in retirement, Ben, is not having to stay up late and finish a dinner at 10 p.m. So.
Right. And finally, you know, you're retiring after, I guess, it'll be 8 years at Gettysburg?
Just shy of nine.
Just almost 9 years. Yeah. If you had, say, another year to 9 years, what would be your next focus? And what would be, you know, what you would hope your successor picks up where you left off?
I would want to continue. Well, actually, my successor will be Betsy Deal, who President Riggs named as the interim vice president. Betsy's an alumna, and also a parent. Her daughter Hannah graduated in 2014. Betsy knows this place inside and out. And I told her just this week, I said, the best legacy that I could have here is for you to go and shatter every record we just set. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that continued focus on those core endowment and current operations is really going to be the key to fundraising in the at least the immediate future. Mm-hmm. And a new president's coming, and who knows what he or she will have on their priority list. So.
All right. Well, Bob Callen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
That's On Target for this week. We'd like to thank Bob Callen for being our featured guest today.
We would also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgian and the executive board of WZBT for their ongoing support in this project. Make sure to subscribe to On Target on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgian and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha, a music major focusing on composition in the Sunderman Conservatory of Music. Join us next week. I don't know who we'll talk to, but I'm sure it'll be great. Have a great week.